Lecture 7, The Flood Tablets.
In previous lectures, we looked at Austin Henry Layard's spectacular discoveries at Nineveh and Nimrud. And we learnt also about the decipherment of cuneiform. These spectacular discoveries triggered not only a flurry of new excavations, but also a frenzied scramble for undeciphered cuneiform tablets, which were much in demand by museums and collectors in Europe. This lecture follows on from the story of Layard and Rawlinson and describes the excavations of Layard's former assistant, Hormuzd Vassam, including his discovery of bas-reliefs depicting King Assurbanipal's lion hunt at Koyunjik. We also learn how marauding brigands wrecked the rafts carrying precious antiquities down the Tigris River, putting a damper on excavations for 20 years. And, as Vassam and others dug, so a small group of scholars deciphered King Assurbanipal's library, discovered by Austin Henry Layard. We tell also the story of the finding of the great flood tablets with an account of a Babylonian inundation and evidence of much earlier civilizations in Mesopotamia. Botha and Layard's excavations prompted a new popular interest in biblical history and in early civilizations in the East. It can be said, and we will find this later in the course when we talk about the excavations into Jerusalem, that the passionate popular interest in the Bible and in the historical truth of the Bible and the scriptures fueled a great deal of archaeological activity during the 19th century. Nowhere is this more true than Mesopotamia. After writing his second bestseller, Nineveh and Babylon, Layard refused to return to Mesopotamia. He was tired of the logistics, of the stress, and of excavating to enormous public expectations with only minimal budgets. So the British Museum appointed his assistant, Hormuzd Vassam, in his place. This was prompted partly by a desire for more spectacular objects, but also by the activities of the French. You'll recall that the French excavations at Khorsabad by Paul-Emile Botha were prompted by a nationalistic desire to repeat the triumphs of Napoleon Bonaparte in Egypt and his scientists with their great Description de l'Égypte. The French had produced a magnificent volume on Khorsabad, illustrated by the artist Flandin. But now they sent out another excavator, a man called Victor Place, who resumed digging at King Sargon's palace. He recovered numerous small objects, and his excavations, which yielded many more bas-reliefs, showed that Sargon's palace had extended over at least 740 acres. It was a vast structure. The British were feeling the competitive pressure, and Hormuzd Vassam was appointed to carry on in Layard's footsteps. Unfortunately, he was a man with nothing like the intellectual or charismatic stature of his predecessor. He was a local. He'd been born in Mosul in 1826. He was a Christian, which was unusual in an Islamic country, and he'd served for many years as Layard's assistant at Koyunjik. He was a volatile and energetic man, but he was a man fueled by a deep sense of insecurity and was desperate for success and fame in the face of competition from the French. He simply resumed excavating, using Layard's methods, tunneling hastily and with little regard for care, trying to find as much as he could, as quickly as he could. His efforts were crowned at intervals with success. In December 1853, he recovered one of the great masterpieces of the British Museum, a magnificent bas-relief of King Ashurbanipal on a lion hunt. This frieze is now in the basement of the British Museum and is something you must go and see if you go to London. It truly is magnificent. You see the king riding out in his private park, mounted on a horse, drawing his bow, girding himself for the hunt. Another scene shows men releasing a lion from a wooden cage. This whole hunt was contrived. And then you see the king drawing his bow and killing a lion which is springing at him. And then there is this superb depiction of a lioness crouched on her haunches, dying, full of arrows. And you know the artist was there. Every line, every piece of the anatomy, the hair is depicted, and you know the man sketched the hunt and sketched the lioness dying. It is deeply moving, and they have displayed it brilliantly, so you can go really close to it and look at the intricate lines and the fine cuneiform accompanying the hunt. Wassam found other bas-reliefs as well. He found a bas-relief, for example, of the king's campaigns in Persia, of the king sitting in state over prisoners of war who were led away or executed. Unfortunately, however, Wassam was a careless excavator. All he was interested in was finding big finds. He wasn't interested in the details. And more, as more antiquities reached Europe, and archaeologists began to sit back a bit and contemplate Assyrian civilization, they realized that what really mattered was to begin to get more detail. Detail on daily life, detail on the nuances of architecture, of the palaces and so on, particularly as they were beginning to conjure up the first reconstructions of these palaces from the finds which had reached the British Museum and the Louvre. Excavations in Assyria ended in 1855. They ended for a number of reasons. One reason was a tragic mishap. In that year, a huge shipment of crates from Khorsabad and Koyunjik, from French and British excavations, were floated together on a fleet of rafts downstream. In the last lecture, I described how this was done so ingeniously. But it was always a hazardous journey, because the Tigris flowed through country which was in constant disorder, which was also inflicted with brigands. And the rafts downstream of Mosul were attacked by marauding bandits and plundered. 235 precious crates of antiquities tipped into the Tigris and were lost forever. Only 78 of them survived. The scientific loss was immense, particularly as Wassam, among other finds, had found many more tablets from the royal library of King Ashurbanipal than had been discovered by Layard. This catastrophe, it was nothing less, signaled the end of the pioneer excavations in Assyria. There was also, at this point, a surfeit of Assyrian kings in Europe. There comes a point where if you've seen one bas-relief of an Assyrian monarch, you've seen them all, because, in a sense, the architecture which communicated the ideology and propaganda of the kings is the same and again and again. At the same time, this was a troubled time. The Crimean War had broken out between France, England, and Russia, and the stories of the bloody victories and the suffering of the troops, and of course the gallantry of Florence Nightingale, consumed the news. Archaeology receded into the background. 20 years were to pass before new excavations began, but this time they began not in the north, but in the south. And now Assyriology became really a matter of scholarly interest rather than a matter of public interest. Just one thing remained, and that was the issue of biblical history and the passionate interest in the history of the Near East, which was fueled by the Assyrian discoveries in a devout age. As excavations ended, the focus of Assyrian scholarship now shifted. It shifted to quiet libraries and museums, and it shifted particularly to the British Museum. Thanks to King Assurbanipal's library, the British Museum really was a center of cuneiform research. The word center perhaps is a bit of a misnomer, because at this time, and we forget this in an era of specialized scholarship and PhD programs, there were only a handful of people who could even begin to read cuneiform and decipher it. After all, it had been deciphered initially by only three people. But the number of people who built on this and were training themselves as decipherers were teeny. Why? A number of very good reasons. Firstly, you needed a command of several languages, old and new. Secondly, you required infinite patience and a passionate interest in the challenge, and it's a very intense intellectual challenge, of deciphering this crabbed script. So only a handful of people, many of them volunteers, ever went to the cuneiform room of the British Museum. It was here that the Royal Library sat, to be cleaned, classified, copied, and deciphered. The cuneiform room was a small, stuffy chamber located above the museum's boiler room. It was presided over by the genial figure of the keeper of Oriental antiquities, a man called Samuel Birch. He was a very congenial fellow who dressed in a rather strange way, that he looked, to quote a contemporary, like a cross between a jockey and a bishop. And, strange although it may seem, he never visited Egypt or Mesopotamia. The reason is simple. He didn't have the time. He was active in learning societies, and he had a great deal of work to do administering the British Museum. But he was an acquisitor. He acquired large numbers of new tablets from dealers who acquired them from illicit digs. Not only in the south, where they discovered that mounds south of Baghdad contained many tablets, but also from Rassam's abandoned excavations. The dealers moved in as Rassam moved away. And the fact that the British Museum was in the market for tablets, as were other museums, simply encouraged destruction and looting, which raised, down the line, some interesting ethical questions, which we'll get into in a moment. Birch was a facilitator. So was Henry Creswick Wallinson, who retired from his diplomatic post and became an active propagator of cuneiform and the translation of it, and he would also often visit the cuneiform room, where he looked over the shoulders of young scholars who were beginning to work on the tablets. One of them was a quintessential Englishman with a quintessential English name, George Smith. A quiet young man, we are told. He only lived to the age of 36, and he is said to have had long, sensitive fingers and a shy demeanor. He started off life as a banknote engraver. He apprenticed himself to a banknote engraver, developed that skill, which of course requires a minute mindset, like the cipherman did, but began increasingly to exercise his passionate interest in Assyrian texts. so much so that in 1867 he was appointed as a tablet translator in the British Museum. For the next 4 years, he laboured in this stuffy chamber above the boiler room, working on cuneiform inscriptions in preparation for a major monograph, a corpus, as it were, of inscriptions in cuneiform to be published by the museum. He was a man who showed few emotions. He was, above all, inobtrusive and quiet. But, by goodness, he was an expert on cuneiform. And then, in October 1872, his fellow students in the cloistered calm of the cuneiform room were astounded when suddenly George Smith leapt to his feet, grasping a tablet, and began, to quote a contemporary, to remove his clothes. He was wildly excited. Probably all he did in an age when you did not show emotion was remove his jacket, which would have been a big move. His colleagues calmed him down, and he told them that on the tablet in his hand, he had found the story of a great flood. And the story of this flood was virtually identical to the flood described in Genesis. His colleagues gulped. The find caused a sensation. And it was a correctly attired, rather diffident George Smith who addressed the Biblical Archaeological Society in front of a large and distinguished audience a month later, which included none less than the Prime Minister, William Gladstone, at which he described the story of the flood on these tablets. But 17 lines of the inscription were missing. With journalistic opportunism, the Daily Telegraph, one of the great papers in London, realized there was a potential scoop here. So they sent George Smith, who had never been out of England, out to Kuyunjik, to Mosul, to try and find the missing 17 lines, the fragments of tablet which contained the rest of the story. Incredible although it may seem, only a week after starting work at Kuyunjik, in 1873, George Smith found the missing fragments, or most of them, on Austin Henry Layard's excavation dumps and carried them back to London. To this day, you can see them in the British Museum, labelled in black ink on the back, DT, Daily Telegraph. George Smith was well aware that the texts of the flood, which he found on the tablets from Assurbanipal's library, were but one of many such Babylonian myths. They were much earlier than the Assyrian king who had kept them in his library. He also suspected that they could be traced to very much earlier tales. We know now that they were part of a much earlier masterpiece of Akkadian and Sumerian literature entitled The Epic of Gilgamesh, The Search of a King for Immortality, an epic so lasting that it's become part of the corpus of Western literature and even today is performed on stage. The flood tablets, as translated by George Smith, tell a story of the good king of Surapak, Atramhassis. The god Enlil is angry. He's angry at humanity and desires to destroy all humans with a vast inundation. There is one exception, Atramhassis, the good guy. Warned by the god Enlil, Atramhassis builds a huge boat and loads his family and what the tablets call the beasts of the field. The rains came and the deluge rises around the boat, floating it on stormy seas. It also destroys humanity, but the ark floats safely on the heaving floodwaters. As the torrent recedes, The boat grounds on Mount Nisir, east of the Tigris River. Atramhassis opens a window, sends out a dove, which returns, then a swallow to reconnoiter the earth. The swallow also returns, but not the raven, who is sent out as they return. The floods recede, and Atramhassis and his crew recolonize the world. The god Enlil grants the devout monarch and his wife immortality. The resemblances in general terms between this story and the Genesis story of Noah's flood are remarkable. So remarkable, in fact, that they were an incendiary fire in the impassioned, devout atmosphere of Victorian England. It should be remembered that at the time the church was feeling somewhat under attack, particularly by the theory of evolution and natural selection published by Charles Darwin in his Origin of Species in 1859, and propagated so effectively by the great biologist Thomas Henry Huxley, who in parenthesis was one of the greatest lecturers of the 19th century and would have been perfect for the teaching company. But alas, he's long dead. But these two factors, the factor of the antiquity of humankind proven by evolution and increasing activity in the discovery of fossil humans, made the devout nervous, who were very nervous about the notion that one was descended from apes. And finds, like the flood tablets, and as we will see later, the floods under the streets of Jerusalem, really validated the fact that the Bible was based in deep historical matrix. The truth may not be exact, but there were remarkable resemblances, and therefore the Bible was true. George Smith himself achieved, by his discovery, a minor notoriety, an immortality if you wish. And, as the fuss over the flood tablets receded, returned again to Mesopotamia, where he recovered from Koyunjik and elsewhere numerous additional tablets. But such activity was becoming hard in the north because the Turkish authorities were becoming increasingly resistant to the removal of what were obviously valuable antiquities from archaeological sites within its domains. And George Smith, in August 1876, left Mosul to travel westward across the Syrian desert. Alas, as so often happens in those days, he caught a fever, dysentery, and died. And in his diary in the British Museum, his notebook, which I've seen, is a moving last entry which said, "The tablets can be found in the bottom of my leather boots." As Smith labored, a humble, inconspicuous man, there were others who rushed in as well, the dealers cashing in on the sudden interest in cuneiform tablets. Today, illegal looters and tomb robbers track the antiquities market on the internet. Today, they're well aware of market values. They were just as aware then, although they found out by different sources. So demand fueled activity. Large shipments of tablets now began to arrive in European capitals, mostly, unfortunately, from unexcavated sites like Nippur in southern Iraq. And this flood of tablets really began to yield new information. That was the positive side of it. It was apparent that there were earlier civilizations, not only in Assyria and at Babylon, but in the far south, which long predated the Assyrians. The Assyrians had inherited ancient literary traditions, myths, and religious beliefs from their predecessors. And it was from these predecessors that the story on the flood tablets of Atramhassis and the Epic of Gilgamesh originated. They were far earlier than the upstart Assyrians. And in 1869, Jules Oppert, one of the original triumvirate of cuneiform decipherers, placed things in context when he proclaimed that the early rulers of the South, and he found this out from tablets, were often called the king of Sumer and Akkad, of the South. Obot argued that the non-Semitic peoples who had preceded the Semitic Akkadians should be called Sumerians. They are still called Sumerians to this day. And a decade later, in 1877, another French consular official, not Botha, but another one, excavating in southern Mesopotamia, was to prove him right. This, in a way, is a crossroads in this course. We've been looking at pioneer excavations in the eastern Mediterranean region. When we return here in a few lectures' time, we're going to be going into a very different era, an era where science began to impact on the discovery of the ancient civilizations. But there's an important point to be made at this juncture, and that is, for the first time in the mid to late 19th century, you began to see some new things emerging. The first of these is the very beginnings of a sense of conscience on of ethics. All these finds, also the Elgin marbles from the Parthenon in the British Museum, the bas reliefs from Koyunjik, from Nimrud and Khorsabad, the Rosetta Stone, innumerable papyri and statuary, the alabaster sarcophagus of Seti I, the Egyptian pharaoh, all of these resided in foreign museums. There was an effort as early as 1835 to start an antiquities museum in Egypt for the locals, but it failed. But for the first time, you heard the first voices after the 1860s beginning to ask questions. Was it ethically right that the achievements of these great civilizations were to be seen and cared for only in European capitals? Was the British Museum official, Wallace Budge, correct when he rather grandiloquently proclaimed that the antiquities of Egypt were safer in the British Museum when they were in Egypt, where they could be enjoyed in perpetuity by everybody? Or did they belong by birthright to the Egyptians? And this ethical debate, which began in the late 19th century, was to fuel powerful forces of nationalism in Egypt, in Greece, and also eventually in Iraq. There were also the beginnings in the 1870s of a change in the techniques of excavation. For the first time, people began not just to look for spectacular antiquities, but begin to look at the details and realize that as they excavated, they were destroying. They were destroying the context of finds in time and space, which would have enabled us to learn, for example, about the method of cataloging of King Assurbanipal's library by studying the layering and the grouping of the tablets, a task to excavate which would have taken months, if not years, today, as opposed to maybe a day in Layard's day. So science was beginning to replace rough discovery. We are on the threshold of a revolution. But before we describe that revolution, we're going to take a journey to the other side of the world and look at the adventures of those who first revealed the Maya civilization of Central America to an astounded world. Notable among them, a well-traveled travel writer, John Lloyd Stevens, an American, who had traveled up the Nile, visited the pyramids, the Valley of Kings, had been to Petra, been to Russia, and his artist friend, Frederick Catherwood, who had spent much time along the Nile and in the Holy Land. And together in New York, they heard rumors of a magnificent civilization in the rainforest, a civilization which had been described very inadequately by some rather eccentric and strange and transitory predecessors, which was now to take the stage and become one of the most spectacular discoveries of the mid-19th century. And with that, we'll bid adieu to the Eastern Mediterranean and journey across the Atlantic to the world of the rainforest and another universe of great cities.